Hello, and welcome to another Sarasota Institute podcast. The Sarasota Institute is a 21st century think tank that is focused on 10 major topics we feel important for the future of humanity. Please go to sarasotainstitute.global to learn more. The Sarasota Institute is a nonprofit corporation.
Hi, and welcome to the Sarasota Institute podcast. A very special welcome to our members, of course. I'm Jason Apollo-Voss, one of the co-founders of the Sarasota Institute, and joining us today is Dr. Harold Wanless. He is of the Department of Geography and Regional Studies at the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Miami. Harold, welcome. So nice for you to join us.
Jason, it's nice to be here.
Harold, before we jump into it, I know from having spoken with David Houle, one of our other co-founders, you have some very interesting responsibilities in your capacity, the Big U at the University of Miami. Could you walk us through some of those responsibilities, first of all?
Well, I guess I could say I'm just a professor. I have the wonderful opportunity to teach a group of outstanding students in geography and geology. And we've been working here since 1971. I've had the opportunity to do research on the evolution of our environments in South Florida and the Bahamas over the last 7,000 years as they evolved to their present situation. And that included a significant but slowing rise of sea level during that time, which we focused on, which is sort of why I got into looking at the future of sea level rise.
Understandable. So I know that exactly the reason we have you on today is because of your expertise in sea level rise, especially relative to the state of Florida, which of course is where Sarasota is located. So walk us through, if you could, your thesis about climate change at a high level. I know that there's a lot of rich detail. Literally, you could spend weeks and weeks talking about all of the intricacies of the science that demonstrates it. But if you could, at a high level, walk us through the most important things we need to know. What makes you certain that there's climate change afoot? And I don't know, maybe 5 to 7? It may be more if you need it.
Well, I think the really important thing is that our atmospheric climate is controlled by a variety of things, but especially the level or the concentration of greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, in the atmosphere. And it's interesting, as we went from the last ice age about 18,000 years ago to the situation at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the carbon dioxide levels increased from about 180 parts per million to about 280. And that was enough to help warm our planet and drive over 420 feet of sea level rise as our great continental ice sheets melted from 180 to 280 parts per million. Since the Industrial Revolution, the burning of fossil fuels has increased that level of greenhouse of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from 280 to 380 to about 415 now. And that's just a huge impact, influence. And since 1950, we have been controlling our climate by our burning of fossil fuels and all the other things that can do that, like solar intensity and so on, are really minor, negligible influences and wouldn't cause the warming we're seeing. We've warmed the atmosphere over 1 degree Celsius since the Industrial Revolution, and most of that has happened since 1950. And that's significant. But the big thing about global warming is that over 93% of the extra heat in the atmosphere has transferred to the ocean. And we've been warming the oceans. And again, that has happened most dramatically in recent years. Half of that heat in the ocean has gone in since 1997. And it wasn't, you know, we've been warming the atmosphere, and I think most people are aware of that by reading the paper, but the warming ocean by the 1990s was sufficient to start melting ice and around Greenland and Antarctica as the slightly warmed ocean water got in under the outlet fjords, deep under the ice sheets. And that's been happening at a dramatically accelerating pace. And, you know, if it was just warming the ocean gradually by the atmosphere from above, that's maybe 6 or 8 or even 12 inches a century if we really worked on it. But when we're now have heat in the ocean sufficient to melt the ice sheets from below by going in these outlet fjords, that is such that we can now have to consider not maybe a foot, but maybe 6 to 12 to many more feet this century. Ice melt, as you can watch it in your glass, when it goes, it goes. And it goes very quickly at an accelerating pace. And that's exactly what we understand. And that's exactly what we're seeing with the rates of ice melt and contribution to sea level rise from Antarctica and Greenland having tripled in the last decade and quadrupled since the turn of the century. And that's just dramatic. And though the numbers are in terms of a few centimeters now, it will be in the terms of a few meters or more by the end of the century. So this is the thing that's of extreme concern, and it's happened so fast. The last 100 parts per million of the buildup of greenhouse gases of carbon dioxide has happened in the last 60 years, whereas coming out of the last ice age, it took like 15,000 years to affect that increase of 100 parts per million of CO2. So we're in uncharted territory. There's nothing in the geologic record like this that we can draw on to understand. And so the thing my students and I worked on, and many others, is trying to understand how sea level coming out of the last ice age. It went up over 420 feet, but it didn't do it as a gradual increase and quite fast and then slowing down. It did it as a series of pulses of rise of 1 to 10 meters of 3 to over 30 feet. Most of them certainly within a century, as some ice sheet sector of land ice rapidly disintegrated and dumped its water into the ocean. The whole way up, it's just one of these pulses after another that left barrier islands and reefs and other things drowned out on the continental shelf and the shore stepped back. And that's how it worked in the past, in a time of warming, in the presence of ice. And that's exactly how it's going to work in the future. Most of our models, the current models of looking at future sea level rise by the U.S. government and so on, are trying to take into account the accelerating feedbacks we're seeing that are speeding up polar ice melt on Greenland and Antarctica. But they don't have the understanding in them of these rapid pulses, these rapid disintegrations of ice melt. I've listed something like 23 different accelerating feedbacks with ice melt that are just dramatically speeding it up. And as I said, this began in the 1990s, the ice melt. And so we're just beginning to see this. And this certainly, this beginning of ice melt is the beginning of a new pulse of sea level rise. But since we have absolutely dramatically increased the levels of carbon dioxide now, this is certainly going to be a big to a very, very big pulse of sea level rise. And we have to anticipate that we don't have centuries to figure out how to control this. We have to be aware that this is happening very rapidly now and will happen at rates that are, most of us would think, are unimaginable. But ice is in a warming world is very unstable.
I've got several responses. The first is, for years and years, I have had the privilege of taking about once per year trip to Europe in about either April through June. And of course, a typical route over to Europe is over Greenland. And I remember the first time ever I flew over Greenland, which was probably 1999. During the day, of course, and you raise your window just to sort of check in and, hey, I've never seen Greenland before. And flying over Greenland in June, it was just a white ice wasteland, basically. There's absolutely nothing there. And increasingly, yep, and alarmingly, every time I fly over roughly this time of year, now with the shade up, and I did it just last year, you see the most beautiful, I mean, beautiful in some ways, but terrible, you know, relative to climate change, but these most beautiful pools of the most crystalline green turquoise water you can possibly imagine that are pooled absolutely everywhere. And increasingly, you can actually see the ground, whereas it used to be ice, and it's fairly scary. So that's one response. And then the second response I have is, I loved your analogy of if you watch ice melt in a cup. Why did I love it? I loved it because that's physics, and physics scales up from the environment of your water glass or your glass of beer or whatever it is you've got your ice in to a global thing. This isn't hyperbole that you're talking about. This is just pure physics, and these are the consequences of warming ice. Correct? Am I right?
Oh, you're absolutely right. And back to the Greenland view from above, there are several changes that have taken place. All these large lakes and pools of water you see that are beautiful, but they're absorbing 90% of the incoming solar heat, whereas the ice, if it's white, is reflecting it. The other change that you see below maybe 2,000 meters, below 7,000 feet, is that a lot of the ice surface has become quite dirty because as the ice was building over the years, it was incorporating all the Gobi Desert dust and the black soot and the brown soot that was carried up there. And as the ice is now melting, it's concentrating that on the surface. And that dark material, dust, dirt, and material is absorbing heat, just like you would do if you're trying to throw dark stuff on your ice or snow on your sidewalk to melt it. And that's just one of these many accelerating feedbacks that are speeding up ice melt. And the water that you see pooled on the surface works its way down either sinkholes, they call them moulins, that have melted into the ice, or fractures. And that softens the ice below, which makes it warmer and more flowable. So that warm water is not just absorbing heat on the surface, it is softening the ice and accelerating its demise dramatically, actually. And so there's all these things that we see going on are, as you say, terrifying.
Yeah, agreed. So another question, you quoted in your discussion an overview of some of the important facts for people listening to the podcast about climate change, and you related them to sea level rises, and specifically it sounded like to Florida. I know that those models are probabilistic, and I'm guessing you're quoting to us either the mean case or the median case. What's the range of that probability distribution that you're quoting? In other words, is that a two-thirds likely scenario? And if so, what's the extreme case on both the left and right tails? What's the right tail sea level rise? In other words, worst case scenario, what's the best case scenario on the left tail?
Well, let me start with what the U.S. government has projected. In 2017, they came out with an updated and increased projection of sea level rise. And they called them scenarios, and they had six of them. The lowest one was continuing as it was. Well, we've already surpassed that. That was I don't know, half meter or less this century. But we're already, sea level rise is already rising faster than that. And then they had that was low. And then they had a intermediate low that was, I don't know, maybe half a meter. And they had an intermediate that was a meter, which is 3.3 feet. And basically, in my opinion, because of the accelerating ice melt, we're already beyond those. And so that leaves three of their sea level projections or scenarios, which were their intermediate, high, and what they called extreme. And those were for 1.5, 2, and 2.5 meters by the end of the century. And those are for the global sea level. And before you try to use those, you have to look and see wherever you live, which in Peninsula Florida, where we are on both coasts, there are two influences that we need to incorporate. One is the changing speed of the Florida Current in the Gulf Stream, because as that slows down, the Coriolis effect, that it turns that current to the right, piling up water in the Atlantic side, that weakens, and we get a sea level rise from that. And we figure on both sides of the Florida Peninsula, that could be an additional, say, 20%. Mm. And then there's another one that you have to add to the global projection. There's another one called redistribution of mass, which is very simply, in the same way that the moon pulls the sea and makes the tides, The huge masses of ice in Greenland and Antarctica actually are a huge mass pulling the ocean toward it. And as it is now melting at significant rates, that pull is becoming less. And the ocean around Greenland, for example, since 2002 or 2003, has dropped about 5 centimeters, and that water has gone elsewhere. And a lot of that water, we're in a focus on both sides of the Florida Peninsula, that we will have a significant increase in our local sea level rise because of this redistribution of mass as the gravitational attraction by the ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland are weakening because they're melting. And we thought that might be another 20%. Isabella Villacogna at University of California, Irvine says that for California and Peninsula Florida, we should add another 52%. So that makes over 70% addition to the global projections that I just mentioned of 1.5 feet, which is 5 feet to 1.5 meters, which is 5 feet, up to 2.5 meters, which is 8.2 feet. You have to add 70% to that. And when you do that, you end up with some quite large numbers for people, especially for us living over here in Miami, where we go, our high. We have less than 3 feet, less than 3% of our land in Miami-Dade County is greater than 12 feet above sea level. Mm-hmm. Now, in the Sarasota area, you have some higher areas, and if you just go a few miles inland, you keep getting higher and higher. Mm-hmm. And you can go all the way into Trail Ridge up over a couple hundred feet. So you at least have somewhere to migrate to, if not being high enough anyhow. But when you take, let's say, 5 feet of sea level rise and add 70% to that, you're up to what, 8 feet or more. And if you take the higher rates, you're going to be higher and higher. And so my thought is that to take these to local levels, these global or these global projections of the U.S. government, You know, that means that we by the end of the century will be somewhere between 7 and 13 feet. And the problem is that could be another 2 feet by 2040 or before. That could be another 3 feet by 2050 or before that. And if we get that kind of acceleration, we'll be accelerating it. As you just hear those numbers, we could be accelerating at more than a foot per decade. And that could lead us to within 50 years, 2070, that could lead us to over 6 feet of sea level rise, which for many areas are all the barrier islands of the world and Florida will be done in well before that. And all our fill land, we have so many areas that we dredge lakes and canals to fill up marsh areas to be 6 feet above sea level. And it's unbelievable the number of areas, you know, the Cape Coral areas, the areas to the north, so many areas on the backside of Barrier Islands are these lovely little places with nice homes and canals, but they're at 6 feet above sea level. And so as you approach
I'm going to interrupt you right there because you're describing something that is well conveyed through a wonderful image. Wonderful, again, it's terrifying ultimately, but wonderful in terms of its succinctness in communicating the story you're telling. I know that you have access to a photograph which shows what the state of Florida looks like with these various sea level rises. For the audience, where can they find a copy of that image, which will communicate one breathtaking, terrifying glance exactly what you're describing?
Well, I gave a handout at my talk up in Sarasota a couple of weeks ago. And I believe that's available online through you. So
It is indeed. With your permission, may we also associate that with today's podcast?
Absolutely. And I show Miami-Dade County on slide six, Miami-Dade and Broward. And Broward, so much, that's where Fort Lauderdale is, so much of Broward is that exact kind of former Everglades that was filled up to plus 6 feet by that process. And so the southern two-thirds of Broward gets in severe trouble very early. But you can see figures 23 and 24 are Naples with a 6 foot rise. And then there are others on down following that. The various types that show how vulnerable the west coast and southwest coast of the Florida Peninsula are.
Yeah, and I'll share with you a bit of ignorance that I comment about frequently. I know you don't know as much about my background as I do about yours, but I actually serve globally advising an organization called the International Integrated Reporting Council, which is it advocates to put forth a new global accounting standard so that all capitals, including natural capital and the effects that business operations have on natural capital, are in fact included in the reporting of their effect. But one of the pieces of ignorance that comes out of those discussions is people will say something like, well, we could build sea walls to protect ourselves. And I know you make the case that Florida's geology is such that we can't do that. But even if we could, it is such a huge misallocation of resources at a global level to build sea walls when all of that capital could be redirected towards cures for any number of dread diseases, or alleviating the suffering from those dread diseases, or addressing global poverty, or if you're more mercenary about it, just reinvestment in, you know, new innovative business ideas. I have to cut off our discussion on the effects on Florida only because I have several other questions I want to ask you, and we have just a little bit of time left. Do you have any prescription for how to alter the trajectory of climate change? I don't know if you spend a lot of time thinking about that, but what are two or three things that people may do or government should do to help ameliorate some of this advancing sea level rise and disaster from a climate point of view?
Well, let me give you the bad news first, and that is that we've warmed the ocean. And we're not going to just turn this around by stopping burning fossil fuels. We're going to be warming the atmosphere for another 30 years if we stop today burning fossil fuels. We're going to be warming the ocean for centuries. Last time the greenhouse gas levels, carbon dioxide levels, were above 400 parts per million in the atmosphere, sea level was 70 to 90 feet. That's where we're headed. And so if we want to even think about altering that, we have to stop putting fossil fuels into the atmosphere, burning fossil fuels. We have to pull a lot of them out, and then we have to hope the ocean will cool down so we don't get all 70 to 90 feet of that sea level rise. If we don't stop, we are now we're going to go on up to 100 and 150 feet of sea level rise, because this is a simple relation of how warm the atmosphere is related to how much greenhouse gases are in it. That's the driving force that we've created in our great global experiment. So the point is that you're not going to stop. The first 20 feet of sea level rise. And I think people have to get used to that. And that's the bad news. The good news is that for your grandchildren or your children, you may be able to prevent it from being 80 to 100, 150 feet of sea level rise. And I think that's by far our obligation. And to do that, we simply have to stop burning fossil fuels. We have to aggressively start pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere so the atmosphere can cool down a bit. And that can start to help take back the heat from the ocean and radiate that out somewhere, hopefully. But that's a big task. And that's not one that buying a Prius or a Tesla and planting 10 trees is going to take care of. But planting, you know, mangroves are by far the most efficient sequesterer of carbon. They have amazing root and root hair systems. Over half the biomass of a red mangrove is in its roots, which is very high. Usually it's 20-25% per tree. And they if you can make them grow, well, they'll grow anywhere, but they're very good in the intertidal zone. You can help sequester. And the reverse problem of that is if hurricanes damage the red mangrove, then they start to decay and do the reverse, releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So that's one thing you can do. The second thing you can do is, and this is hard, vote for people that are going to do something about climate change. And I say that cautiously because we can look back from Clinton on and we've had people talking about climate change and nobody has really done anything that's dented the problem. So we really have to treat this in the same way we're treating the coronavirus as we're starting to almost declare war on it now by doing extreme things. And we're not sure they're the right things, but we're certainly trying hard. We're doing things that I haven't ever seen happen before. But that's the level of concern we have to bestow upon climate change.
Well, Harold, thank you so much for being with us today. And for those of you listening to the audience, we will, of course, associate his recent presentation at the Leap Year Look at Climate Change event that took place, of course, on Leap Day, the 29th of February, so that you can see those images to which he's referring during our conversation today. Harold, thanks so much for joining us. And also thank you, for volunteering your time. This is mission critical times and really appreciate it.
Yeah, Jason, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Harold.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please go back to where you downloaded this podcast to find another one that might be of interest to you. Thank you.